I noticed Karen reading my notes. And I thought, well, that's awesome. If she can read them at all, then she can just, I don't know, whatever else you needed to do. And just whatever I was going to say is in the notes. So to the degree that that's important, you can just, you can go. I woke up this morning to a dark house. That's not unusual. Usually the dog and I are the first ones up on any morning, never mind on Sunday morning. But I woke up to this beeping sound. It was not my alarm. And so when you wake up to a beeping sound in your house that you, it doesn't usually happen, you kind of go, what's that noise and should I pay attention? And I realized it's the beeping sound that my backup power supply makes right before it runs out of juice and the computer that's connected to it, in which, among other things, my notes reside, goes dead. So I hopped out of bed and dashed toward the computer just in time to hear the beep, 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 beep that happens right before it goes dead, and then it went dead. So I woke up to a dark house because the power was out in our part of Manitoba this morning and had been out for quite some time, judging by the state of the power supply. So my carefully planned, thought through, written in advance, blah, 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 on which I based the blurb for the week, is lost in the ether. So I got up and I thought, first I thought, what can I remember about what I was planning to talk about? And then I thought, no, that's dumb. I'm not going to try to do that because it's already done. I'll just, another day. What's going on inside of me that was behind what I decided to write down? That I don't have to have notes in front of me, exhaustive notes, careful notes, to kind of work my way through. And the reason I write things down the way that I do before I come to speak is because I believe that words matter. And because I often feel like in this context where we're exploring what we believe, we're opening ideas. And I want to do that with care. I want to do that with some diligence. And I want to do it with a particular group of people in mind. It's not an exercise that I do just for me. I feel like it's my responsibility to be careful with that task because it's for us. That's part of what I'm responsible for. And so I want to take care with it. That said, I think it's possible to be too careful in a role like the talky bit leader. And one of the results of that can be that the human goes missing, and all that's left are the ideas. So I thought what I would do this morning is something more like improvisation and less like a rehearsed song. I don't think one of these is more valuable than the other, but they're not the same. So the amount of notes that I have written down to me as a speaker feels more like what key is this in and what's the progression, rather than the full melody and all the arrangement. So this is a little bit of a riff on what was going on inside of my mind and heart this morning. More like what the, isn't it funny how when you want to quote someone, you wonder about their credibility? This may be a morally complicated person to quote at the moment in terms of the news cycle, but I don't think their knowledge about their skill set is called into question. Steve Kirby, who's been formerly the head of the Jazz Studies program at University of Manitoba, has been in the news a fair bit. The last week and a half or two, for all sorts of reasons that we would wish would never need to be in the news, but when they happen, we can be grateful that they're surfaced and we can get to work on the problem. Kirby used to call improvisation spontaneous composition. It's not a song, just because you didn't sit down and work it out note by note. I think that idea still has the same merit that it had before the events of the last week and a half. When Tim spoke a couple of weeks ago and gave us all those pictures of space and kind of the zoom out of that got us to that well-known image of Carl Sagan's little blue dot, and then I talked about time subsequent week and kind of took that how big are our ideas in the context of this larger story idea from a different space. When I called Tim or emailed Tim rather the week after he spoke just to kind of check in and say how'd it go. We had an email exchange. There was more to it than this, but one of the things that Tim said was, well, nobody shouted out that I was a heretic, so that was good. Which I agree with him. That is good. And I emailed something back to the effect of, isn't it nice to be in an environment where, you know, shunning and lynching are sort of not the norm. But as I reflected on that exchange a little bit, I realized that the thing that stuck for me about that exchange was the question, why did that even need to be on anybody's radar? Why did that possibility even need to exist in this conversation? Not why did Tim feel that way, but why is this a question that I would recognize as a normal one, you know? A feeling that's a normal one, this feeling of I'm not describing Tim's feelings here now, I'm describing general feelings that go with this. Feelings of fear or reservation about exploration of ideas or beliefs. Concern about how unfolding an idea that doesn't have a tidy package at the end might feel. What the results of such an initiative might be. Why? Why is this part of the story? Part of the experience? And I wanted to just reflect on that a little bit this morning. I think there are lots of us in this room that have been taught that there is only one right version of the story of who God is, how we might think about the divine, and about what the relationship between the divine and the human might be. Many of us have been thoroughly steeped in the idea that there is only one right way to think about that. But our life experience doesn't square with that. Because we know by experience that stories don't behave that way. In fact, we know by experience that even things that we call facts don't behave that way. I'm not going to lay out any documented studies this morning because, like I said, this is a riff, not an arranged song. But they're not hard to find. The way we perceive things that we regard as concrete and immutable is remarkably pliable. Even the facts don't behave that way. I'm not advocating for a fact-free universe here, by the way. Stories have lots of facets. They can be told so many different ways and still be true. I'll give you an example. Many years ago, I was wishing that I'd had the time. I mean, I honestly, these are the notes that I wrote down when I came here early this morning because I thought it'd be good to do that where I had some light. I also had to bring my shaving stuff with me so I could shave where there was like warm water and lights, neither of which I had at home. I'm getting ready in the Pantages bathroom going, I feel like an indie musician. Anyway. many years ago, one of the things that I did for a few seasons in my life was I was a wilderness guide. I led canoe trips and climbing trips and all this kind of fun stuff. And my first summer as the person who was responsible not just for the group of people I was guiding, but for the entire organization that I was working for. So I was the boss that summer. It's the first time I'd had an experience like that, a young guy. First night out on the first trip of the season. And I decided that I was gonna be a hard man. I was gonna do this like the real kind of voyageur way. And I was not gonna sleep in a tent that summer. Because, you know, the voyageurs didn't, right? We're paddling where they paddled. We were up north in the Churchill system in voyageur territory. And I thought, I'm going to sleep under my canoe like all summer. All right. So it's night one. And I'm following through, you know. So I put the canoe on its side, and there's a bit of space under there. And I'm thinking, okay, there's a little flaw in this plan right away. Because, for one thing, the voyageurs' canoes were way bigger than the canoe that I was using to shelter myself. And so the space underneath this thing was not that big. So So I thought, well, I'll kind of augment this. So I put a couple of paddles there and ground sheet that I had in my pack. And so I kind of had this little shelter. And this is northern Saskatchewan, so the bugs and I were sharing space. Anyway, and I wasn't quite as, I probably didn't smell quite like a voyageur yet. Later in the summer, that worked better. But anyway, early going. So I still smelled pretty much like I came from a place with soap. And I think the mosquitoes were thinking that was just awesome. So anyway, I climb into my little sheltered space under the canoe, and I kind of get settled for the night. And I'm just starting to fall asleep, and I hear this. So this little kind of scurry noise, right? Woods are full of noises at night, so whatever. So I'm kind of like, okay, I just dismissed that in my mind, and I'm just sort of nodding off to sleep, and I hear this womp, and whatever the is, like, crashes into my sleeping bag. So now I'm awake, right? Because, you know, I was planning to sleep alone under the canoe, and now I'm not alone. There's a creature that's in my space. So I kind of, you know, whatever, I react, I twitch, and things go quiet. And so I'm like, okay, all right, you know, little critter, big critter, this is all fine. I'm going to go to sleep now. Again, I'm just about asleep. And same thing, you know, this. But this time, when the critter hits my sleeping bag, it like travels off up onto it. Okay? So now there's a creature like running on me. And so that, you know, wah, twitch, thump into the bottom of the canoe, and then it scurries away. So this happens a couple more times. I can't catch it. I can't, like, all I can do is react. So I'm starting to feel a little impotent in this situation. Anyway, in the final event, I flung it hard enough. It got tired of the game. I don't know exactly, but it went away. And that was sort of the end of that incident. And I did spend the entire summer sleeping under my canoe. Now, that's how that story goes. Those are the facts. Like, that actually happened to me. This is how I remember it. That's how that went. And I could tell the story just like that. So it's kind of this funny story about a young guy who doesn't have that much experience and who's trying to be a hard ass and, you know, gets scared half to death by a mouse, right? So there you go. There's that version of the story. I can also tell that same story as a story about insecurity. Why was I sleeping under the canoe while my staff were in tents with the sometimes very challenging kids that we were dealing with? Like, really? What kind of leadership is that? Good luck, guys, with all that relational stuff, you know? I'm going to be over here under my canoe if you're having, like, a full-on medical crisis, come and get me, but otherwise you just deal with the relational stuff. Why did I choose that? I could tell this story as a story about the fact that when I did finally go to sleep after the critter left, I only slept for, I don't know, like half an hour, and I was wide awake. Because my brain was going a million miles an hour with all the responsibilities that I felt like were suddenly uniquely mine that summer. And I crawled out from under the canoe, and I went and sat by the rapids that we were camped beside until the sun came up. Had nothing to do with the critter. Had nothing to do with sleeping under the canoe. I was just like, what am I doing? This is nuts. These people should not be trusting me with this job. It was better the second night. I could tell the story that way, too. It's the same story. Stories do not behave like material objects. They are more like, and this is an image I think that I think Rob Bell accesses in his current book, What is the Bible? He I think he has a chapter in it, if I remember correctly, called Turning the Gem. Stories are more like that. Stories are more like gemstones. We might look at them and go, that's one gemstone, that's one story, but it has all these different facets, all these different ways of being looked at and thought about and appreciated and examined and explored. That's an important idea when it comes to exploring what we believe. Because if we grew up being taught that there's only one right version of the story of the divine and humans, we've already decided that that story doesn't behave like anything else in our lives. That it's immutable in a way that means it's not open to exploration. And that if we explore it, we are in danger. We're somewhere we should not be. That's not a very helpful starting place when it comes to exploration. It's not a very helpful place to live in. And what I want to do is I want to contend that the Bible, among other things, that version of the story of God and people is a lively one, that it's actually alive and meant to be interacted with the way that other living things are meant to be interacted with. There are many, many different ways to come at that story. And if we are open to it, that story will always surprise us. It will always surprise us. But why do we sometimes feel so reluctant or afraid to do that? I want to just suggest a few ideas about why we might feel that way when it comes to exploring what we believe, why we might feel reluctant to do it or afraid to do it. I think one of the simplest reasons why we might feel that way is because it's easier to not do it. This may be a misattribution, it may be an internet attribution, but in my memory, it's Einstein who said that thinking is hard work, that's why so few people do it. It is easier to take what is handed to us than it is to think for ourselves. That's just, broadly speaking, I think that's just true. It doesn't cease to be true when it comes to what we believe. It doesn't cease to be true when it comes to what we believe about our spirituality. It doesn't cease to be true when it comes to why we do the things that we do, why we make the choices that we make, why we act the way that we act in our lives. One of the reasons why I think we're reluctant to turn the gem, to look at the stories on which we might base our lives from more than one angle, is because it's just easier not to. And another reason why I think that we're sometimes reluctant to do that is because if we examine what we believe, really, authentically examine it, we have to also examine the way that we're living, because they go together. We all arrive, and this is a paraphrase for sure, but we all arrive in the world with what commonly attributed to Plato, we all arrive in the world fired with a madness from the gods, with energy, would be another way to say it. And long before we do anything explicitly religious with that energy, in terms of what we think the world means, we act out of it. We do something with it. We make decisions, we choose actions, we live with that energy. What we do with the energy with which we arrive in the world is our spirituality. So long before we have a religious particularity to our spirituality, we have a spirituality. And what's behind those actions, if we want to give another word to that energy, the word that I would choose would be the word desire. We act toward what we desire. So desire is like the engine for that energy. And so what we desire is also essential to our spirituality. This is one of the reasons, by the way, why eros and spirituality are so often interconnected when we form religions, when we make something of our spirituality and formalize it. Not always in good ways, right? This is one of the reasons why our beeper goes off when we encounter a cult where the spiritual leader is having sex with 15-year-olds and saying God said it was fine, for instance. So there's a busted version of that, but we could go on. We could illustrate this ad nauseum. But the connection between who we are in our desire, by which I illustrated it from sexuality, but of course I could illustrate it much more broadly than that, but who we are in our desires becomes who we are in our actions, and in the end, that's our spirituality. Regardless of what we claim religiously. So we all have a spirituality. It might move us toward integration, it might move us toward disintegration, it might move us deeper into connection with other people, with the planet that we call home, with the divine, or it might move us away from those things. And that's really the litmus test in the end for our spirituality, is which way is this taking me as a person, as a human being? Not, am I believing the right thing? We'll get to that in a bit, I think. We'll see. But how am I acting? What am I doing with the energy that's mine? So one of the reasons we don't like to do the work of exploring what we believe is because it pushes us back to this. It pushes us back to, why am I doing what I'm doing? What if I'm doing what I'm doing because I think it's going to get me what I want? And I start to look at what I'm doing and going, oh God, like if that really points to what I want, do I really want that? Do I want the thing that that behavior points to? Do I want the thing that I'm expending my energy toward? This is a great relational question, by the way. Right? Very compelling, painful one sometimes, but a really important one. Is the way that I'm acting moving me toward integration with this person or with these people that I say that I love? Because if it's not, I got to ask myself some serious questions about why I'm behaving the way that I'm behaving. What do I believe that is causing me to make this choice? What is it about my spirituality that is compelling me, impelling me, drawing me, deceiving me? Pick one that is causing me to act this way. And so one of the reasons we don't like to examine what we believe is because it pushes us back into our life. And we have to look at it. And most of the time, at least some aspect of that is not going to be a very pleasant part of the experience. We may also discover some things that are unexpectedly lovely or unaccountably good. It's not just bad news. But it can be a little bit frightening to consider. If we examine what we believe, we have to examine how we're living. I think another reason why we're sometimes reluctant to explore what we believe is because dogma, let's define our terms a little bit. I'm thinking of this primarily religiously, although any collective may have dogma. Dogma is, in its sort of simplest form, an authorized idea. It can be authorized by any kind of a collective. It tends to take a collective to authorize an idea, right? So by an institution, by a profession, by a group of colleagues, by a religious order, so on and so forth. In religion, in particular, it's an idea that is authorized by the church, historically, in the Christian religion. One of the reasons we're reluctant to explore what we believe is because dogma provides a shortcut to community. And we don't want to threaten that. And what I mean by that is simply that if we are with people who also ascribe to the same belief in a visible, articulated, perhaps acted out way, and we can ascribe to that same belief, we're in. And oh my God, we are so hungry to be in. There's a thing that we can't make go away no matter how hard we try. I would argue that we don't need to make it go away. In fact, we oughtn't. We need to pay attention to it, but we need to be conscious of what it is. One of the reasons we don't like to explore what we believe is because we're afraid that if we get outside of the pale of whatever the community believes, we're not going to end up in the community. We're going to get punted. We're going to get shunned. We're going to get shamed. We're going to get chastised. We're going to get locked up. Whatever. Depends on the community. Depends on the severity. Depends on the power. Depends on lots of things. But we're afraid that we're going to be an outcast if we explore what we believe, and we end up somewhere other than the community. That's sort of the formal version of the impact of dogma, but we have families too. We have loves in our life. We have people that we just care about and journey with. What happens if I go exploring my belief and I end up in a space that I know is different than the space that they operate in, and they're really passionate about their space and I'm really passionate about mine? What's going to happen to that relationship? How could that not be scary? Of course we're concerned about that. So one of the reasons that we don't examine what we believe is because we're afraid we're going to get outed. We're going to lose something that's precious to us. That's such a legitimate fear. And here's a question. If we are so afraid that ending up in a different space of belief is going to cast us out of the community that we love, whatever shape that community has, what's the shape of that community? What sort of community would toss somebody out because they end up believing something different? And do I want to be part of that? How will I be a part of that if it's not healthy, but I already belong here? Families come to mind when I say something like that, right? What if I'm part of a family system where either you ascribe to the same set of beliefs or you're trouble and you're in trouble? I'm thinking of no one's story in particular when I say this, but I have a collection of stories from my own experience as a pastor and just as a human, of people for whom this has been the way this has gone. They've discovered something. Their beliefs have shifted in some way. They've articulated that, or they've come out about that. And all of a sudden, they are formally rejected by their family, by their spouse, by their lover, by their colleagues, by people that matter in their lives. What an agony. What an enormously painful thing to experience. We can't dismiss that by just saying, well, that whatever that group was that behaved that way, they've got a belief structure problem, so I'm just going to let them go their way and I'm going to go mine, thanks very much, because we're already inextricably intertwined with many of these things, deeply. And in fact, the issue may be not about love at all. We may have gone off on an exploration that just took us into this whole idea space that's foreign to the group. But our affection, our shared history, our family bond, our relational bonds, they might all still be just more or less what they were as far as we're concerned. And if we bump into an idea that suddenly has this entire group responding as though we were a pariah, that's going to hurt. And we know it's going to hurt. And so we back away. Then we have to live with internal dissonance, right? Then we have to live with, what do I do with this thing that's unfolding inside of me or around me that just is core to me? Do I betray myself? Do I become a faux person whenever I'm in that setting? Do I just act the way that I know the group will recognize? Listen, this is about religious code, among other things, right? I don't know if you ever thought about religious code words or not, but they're super potent. In lots of settings, the way that I talk about spirituality here and Christian spirituality here would immediately provoke a reaction from the group that made them wonder if I was, and I use a code word advisedly here, if I was a believer. I had a conversation like this last night. A week ago, I got an evaluation from a different event where people were like, I think this guy's New Age. Like, I don't think he's a Christian at all. And they were using their code words for, I don't understand the perspective this person's coming from. Right? Because I didn't use the language that they were familiar with. I didn't roll out the code words. I didn't drop in the key phrases at the right time. Now, as it happens, that way of talking and thinking about the divine makes me bristle. Because I think it's dangerous. I think it's short-sighted. I think it produces a handoff that I don't believe is healthy for human beings, which is when we hand over what we believe to an institution. We hand it off to dogma. We shortcut the process of what do I believe. So I'm really resistant to that personally, and I know that about myself. It's not always good news, but it is true. And so when I talk about these things, about spiritual things, I don't want to fall into code language. I don't want to fall into drop the right phrase in at the right time. In fact, I kind of want to provoke something really different than that. My job, as I understand it, in the world, occupationally as well as vocationally, is not actually to reassure believers. It's not a bad job for someone to have. It's just not mine. And so I try to be faithful to that. I try not to do that when I talk about spiritual things. I actually view my job as more like lobbing grenades, more like idea grenades. Boom, boom. Lob them out there. I don't have to resolve the question. That's not my job. Now, that doesn't necessarily produce very reassuring talks about God. I do understand that. It's one of the reasons why, frankly, if our goal was to be a bigger church, I don't think we'd succeed as long as you let me keep talking. Because that's not very comforting. And one of the things lots of us come to religion for is comfort, is reassurance. I'm not arguing that that's a bad thing. I'm just arguing that it's an incomplete thing. One of the reasons we don't question what we believe is because dogma provides a shortcut to community. That said, I would contend that the community that dogma provides a shortcut to is not authentic. By which I mean it's not honest, primarily. Anytime I've been part of a group of people where if you asked the group collectively, do you all believe the same thing, and you got back the answer yes, that answer was not true. And it didn't take very long to find out that it wasn't true. All you had to do was talk to the individuals instead of the group. And then you find out that even the gem of this codified belief, when you turn it, was an individual, had another facet. And even if we used the same code language, we didn't mean the same thing by the code. We're perspectival knowers. This is who we are as human beings. And so that's the way we know and experience things. And so even if we say, I believe the same thing as the person beside me, we don't. Because our belief is intersectional, and our intersection at which we form and practice that belief is not the same as their intersection. And so even if we use the same sentence, we don't mean the same thing by it. We can't. It's impossible. This is actually good news, because it means that we have a rich, biodiverse realm in which to believe and act. So if you run into a community that says the only way to be in this community is if you believe exactly what the community believes, you can know, like right out of the chute, that you are not in the presence of authentic community. You are in the presence of a facsimile of community. It doesn't mean it's not powerful. It doesn't mean it's not reassuring. But it means it's not true. It's not honest. Because we can't know things that way. But it's very reassuring to hand off exploration to dogma and enjoy the shortcut to the thing that feels like community. One more. Because solos can go on too long. I think one of the other reasons why we're sometimes so reluctant to explore what we believe is because we've been taught, many of us, that right belief is what makes God happy. Or at least it makes God less unhappy. And this is an important idea. This is recognizably ancient. The Egyptians come immediately to mind. By the way, the Egyptians had an enormous amount of influence over the Hebrews, historically, that whole part of the world. And so one of the things that happens when the Hebrews kind of get this idea from their neighbors that God is one is that they borrow it from, among others, the Egyptians. The Egyptians didn't build pyramids just because they were interesting architectural structures. They also built pyramids because they were interesting spiritual structures to them. And one of the reasons that they're interesting to compare to Egyptian spirituality is because they're so visibly oriented toward the pinnacle. If you look at Egyptian spirituality in the same period of history, so early Bronze Age, sort of as the Hebrew people are emerging as a people group, one of the things you recognize immediately in the shape of that spirituality is that all the labor happens kind of at the bottom. And then as you move up the peak, you get to the Pharaoh. And when you get to the Pharaoh, what you get to is you get to the highest possible human representation next to the divine. And the Pharaoh mediates the divine to the people, to the rest of the pyramid. It's the ultimate top-down spiritual structure. All the power resides at the top. And all the work resides elsewhere. Right? This is an important spiritual idea because this is the idea that the Hebrews leave. So in terms of the history of the Christian religion, the history of the Hebrew people, which is the stream in which Christianity stands, that's what they were fleeing from, was that idea of human-divine interaction. That what the way that this works is that there's a person at the pinnacle, a human at the pinnacle, and they mediate between God and humanity. They distribute the truth, and they hold the human instance or expression of power, of the power of God. It's not very hard to see how this is also the combination of church and state in the early history of the West, that one of the reasons why the settler aboriginal indigenous conversation is where it's at in Canada is because people arrived from that mindset into this country, which had a completely different spirituality already humming along just fine, thank you very much, and introduced this idea that they were here as representatives of God and country. That's why you could stick a flag on a chunk of dirt and call it your nation, is because you were authorized by God to do it. This is partly why the conversation keeps stalling, is because we haven't kind of talked about this part, you know? We haven't kind of got at the guts of this thing and gone, of course this is screwed up. The idea behind it is the exact idea that this whole belief system that authorized it was supposed to be undoing. The idea of God among us is central to the idea that is at the heart of Christianity. Not above us, not mediated to us by somebody from a special spiritual position, but everywhere. One of the reasons why we're reluctant to explore what we believe is because we've been taught that right belief is what placates the God. It's what makes God less pissed off. And so we're on this quest for right belief. Instead of examining what we believe and how we live with an open heart and an open mind, because we're afraid that if we get it wrong, God's going to whack us. Recognizably ancient perspective on the nature of the divine. Need to keep evolving that one, I think. There's a different way to think about this wider story in which we do our exploration here at the table. And the simplest version of it that I can think of is that we could think about it like a relationship. We could think about it more like exploring a relationship, by which I don't mean Jesus and me. I mean exploring a relationship with what in the final event will be remain mysterious to us. Not unknowable, but not fully able to be known. It's more like, in my life, it would be more like my marriage, honestly, where this other person to whom I am so intimately connected remains, in the final event, a mystery to me. And it's not because I don't know more than I did. I do know more than I did. Some of what I've learned has been lovely, unfathomably, beautifully so. Some of it's been not very nice at all. This is mutual, of course. The mystery remains. So does the exploration. And so does the surprise. More like that. Did you ever think about coming to the story that's running in the background of what you believe, the text, even if you will, the Bible, that way? That this is a story that is full of endless surprises. It's also full of good news. It's also full of not good news. There's no end to what can be explored here. But somehow we have to get around that corner of what are the reasons that keep backing me away from this, so I can explore this without my first gut reaction being, if I get this wrong, I'm screwed. That's a hard corner to turn. I don't know if any of this is helpful in turning it. That's all I'm going to say about it this morning. Back to the song that we planned to sing. Peace.